So all of this fintech that we have been doing, all of us, the telcos, the banks, you know, the OTT players, everyone, all of us have not yet reached 10% of like the actual solving the actual problem, right? And there's a lot of work to be done. I think people generally severely underestimate the significance of this issue of the lack of infrastructure that's being built for the first time.
Africa's payments landscape is full of icons. Interswitch, Paga, Paystack, and Flutterwave, to name just a few. And with good reason. Moving money digitally is a fundamental activity in a digital economy. But when it comes to consumer payments, what infrastructure is needed? Why do some payment methods work better in some places than others? And is infrastructure building the best way to create value? Or is owning the last mile through an API the golden ticket? On this episode of The Trajectory Africa, we'll hear from Wiza Jelakasi, Director for Africa Market Development at eBanks, a payments processor headquartered in Brazil. He'll shed some light on why building payment rails in Africa is deceptively hard work. Let's get into it. Wiza, welcome to The Trajectory Africa. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Tayo. Super excited to be here and happy to jump in.
Excellent. So it might be a bit of an understatement to suggest that you have, let's call it an unusually multidimensional set of experiences that span coding, founding companies, working for multiple startups, both on the front and back end of B2B and B2C startups, navigating office openings, expansions, acquisitions, probably things I'm missing. And fortunately for me, it's pretty much everything that is needed and then some to decode the first principles of consumer payments in Africa. So perhaps obviously it's a real privilege and a pleasure to chat with you about this.
No, I'm super delighted and honored to be considered for this recording. I think you've been really thoughtful about how you structure the conversations that take place here. And I'm just excited to share more about all of my strong opinions.
Thank you so much. I try to be thoughtful in order to make space for strong opinions. So before we jump in, maybe we can kind of establish why you're here, as in why you're interested in payments, given the breadth of fintech experience you have. So what do you find compelling about the payment space and why do you stay in it?
For me, I think it's really about like enabling access. I'm originally from Malawi, and I've had the privilege of living in a few African countries now, spent quite a bit of time in Nairobi, Kenya, and now I'm in Johannesburg in South Africa. And the quality of the opportunities that I've been granted in the world has really been a function of my ability to draw compensation or to be paid from those opportunities. And, you know, the more I think about it, the more I realize that, like, just far too many people aren't able to meaningfully participate in the global economy because they don't have access to the relevant payment methods that would allow them to get paid and also to pay to access certain things. And I think that this is a truly fundamental problem for the African people because our institutions on the continent are so very young. And we're only now just starting to think through and figure out how do we, you know, generate opportunities for wealth creation and wealth preservation at scale. And I think that payments plays a very big part in that. And it's like the smallest things, like right now I'm paying for GPT, ChatGPT premium. It's $20 a month. It's not a lot of money. But it has supercharged my productivity and saved me time in very clear and compelling ways. And I know a bunch of people who would benefit from being able to use tools like this, but it's not something that they would even consider because, you know, when they try to put their card online to pay, it just won't work. So that's why I'm in the payment space.
No, that makes complete sense. I have a friend who's done a fair amount of thinking and is starting to write about the ways in which Africans, and I know Africa is a large continent, but Africans are disintermediated from the global economic and financial system and systems.
And for better or for worse, payments is one of the main rails for people to participate and to benefit and to kind of transcend the limitations of their geography, for lack of a better way of putting it. So from that perspective, if you were to zoom out and think about how payments came to be, would you be able to identify milestones from your perspective in the evolution of payments infrastructure that shapes how the system currently looks?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to speak to that from like a continental perspective that speaks to every country. But I think there are like common themes that emerge in a lot of the big ones in sub-Saharan Africa. So I would divide the continent into three types of payment ecosystems. Number one is bank-led, a bank-led ecosystem. This would be countries like Nigeria and South Africa. I would also have a cash-led ecosystem, countries like Egypt and Morocco. And then I would also have a mobile money-led ecosystem, Kenya being the obvious one, but then also Uganda, Ghana, Tanzania, Zambia, Malawi, most of the Francophone African countries, Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, etc. Those all make up the mobile money sphere. And I'll try to like speak to some key moments in all of them. I think mobile money is a pretty interesting one. Chronographically, I think it begins with the advent and introduction of mobile phones in Africa, which was, you know, relatively recent, mostly in the late 90s, where you had telcos popping up. You had businesses that like Celtel that was acquired by Zain and then eventually acquired by Airtel, bringing mobile phones to the population at significant scale for the very first time and enabling people to think about value digitally for most people, really for their first time in their entire lives, through the concept of prepaid airtime. So I remember like growing up back in the day in Malawi, you could buy your airtime, and for some reason, airtime was denominated in US dollars, and you would buy like, you know, with 1,000 kwacha, you would get like, you know, $10 of Celtel airtime. And that got people thinking and caring about digital finance for the very first time. And, you know, trying to figure out what the value of a dollar is because your airtime is denominated in that currency. And that obviously took off like wildfire. And, you know, within a very short space of time, you know, circa a decade or so, mobile phones were commonplace in many African countries, far exceeding some core metrics like access to electricity in most countries. And then you have in the early 2000s, the advent of M-Pesa in Kenya, which was the first telco-led mobile money solution to really be deployed in any country at any significant scale. And it did take a little bit of time to catch on in Kenya, predominantly powering domestic remittances from urban centers to more rural areas. The equivalent at the time was people, you know, giving bus drivers envelopes full of cash and hoping that they actually get them to their grandma. And I think that M-Pesa story was really a catalyst in illustrating to the rest of the continent how powerful a payments ecosystem can be. And I think telco groups saw that and attempted to replicate it in their own countries to varying degrees of success. And most of those attempts have been very successful. Despite not being the first mover, the MTN group today runs the largest mobile financial services products on the continent through MTN Momo. It's the largest by volume, and it's also the largest by footprint. You also have Orange, the French-based telecom giant that invested heavily in Francophone Africa. I think they're present in about 10 or 11 African countries and have done extremely well too. And of course, not discounting the Vodafone group, who are part owners of Safaricom in Kenya, but also Vodafone in DRC and Vodacom in South Africa. They've seen pretty decent success in all of those markets. South Africa is a bit tricky, though, I think because it's a bank-led ecosystem and there's a lot of cultural significance with having a bank account. There's also implications around your access to credit. The credit ecosystem in South Africa is very mature. It's comparable to some European countries. So as a rite of passage, people have to get a bank account and get a credit card and do all sorts of things. And for that reason, mobile money hasn't really taken off there. When you look at other bank-led ecosystems like Nigeria, I think a really big thing is that for a very long time, Nigeria's banking system was antiquated and not suitable for what the economy needed. And around the early 2000s as well, a decision was made to invest into really what was then and still is by some measures cutting edge infrastructure at a central bank level to enable a digital payments ecosystem. One of the consequences of that approach was the advent of the Nigerian Interbank Settlement System, which has got a specific product called National Instant Payments. And if you want to transfer money from one bank account to any bank account in Nigeria, even if it's in a different bank today, that transaction is pretty much instantaneous, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. When I contrast that with ACH in the US, it makes me want to pull my dreadlocks out. But you can sort of like see how that really drove the adoption of financial services at a grassroots level in a way that a more traditional approach wouldn't have. Some people like to use the term leapfrogging to describe this. I'm not a very big fan of the word, but I think we can use it here. And for me, those are some important moments in the context of the digital economy here.
Yeah, really interesting. I appreciate the way that you categorize the drivers of the ecosystem. So bank-led in Nigeria, cash-led in Egypt, Morocco, et cetera, and then mobile money-led in Tanzania, et cetera. Any insights as to why certain methods become predominant in different areas?
I think it's mostly about what are the alternatives that are already in the market and how much more convenient or cheaper or faster is your solution. And if your solution hits all three of those markers, there is a decent chance of seeing success at scale. In order to illustrate this point, I think it's easier to look at the markets where you don't have mobile money dominance or where it's not like very relevant as a payment method. Starting again in Nigeria, if I can use my bank account to instantly transfer money from my bank account to any other bank account, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, why do I really need a mobile money service, right? Right. Like my bank is also going to give me, you know, access to credit. My bank is going to give me investment products. My bank is going to give me everything, right? And it ends up being that you sort of like, if you try to deploy mobile money in a telco sense, in a market like Nigeria, you have to like look really hard for a unique value proposition that would, you know, drive adoption. And in a market like Nigeria, cost is actually one of the predominant factors. So if you actually like make your transactions free and make it free for people to send money to bank accounts, that could be a very strong driver. You also look at South Africa as a market, which is very strong bank-led, very strong payments infrastructure. Mobile money is struggling to find a gap to fill in South Africa because you have a very high rate of bank population amongst the highest on the continent, I think at about circa 70 or 80%. Most of those people need to have bank accounts in order to access some critical services that they cannot get anywhere else. So such as like financing to get a house or a car, which is a thing in South Africa. It's not a thing in many African countries. In Nigeria, you might be asked to pay your rent up front for a year. But in South Africa, you might be, you know, 28 years old with 5 years of experience working your first job, and you get a bond to buy, you know, a 4-bedroom house in a posh area that you can live in for the next 15 years.
Wow.
And it's actually really incredible. So when you have that sort of ecosystem, I think mobile money struggles to fit in. Where it succeeded was because there was no real strong alternative. Banks were really not focused on the retail consumer. They were focused on business. And the few retail consumers that they got were more of the affluent segment of the population, not the masses in rural areas who still have a need for financial services, but weren't adequately being served. And distribution is also a very big factor. With mobile money and digital financial services, you could distribute your service much more easily than a traditional bank could. And you could reach a much wider audience, meeting them where they are on their SIM card in their home, rather than expecting them to come to you. And I don't think that anyone could have really foreseen the speed with which mobile would become relevant as an infrastructure layer on the continent. And, you know, the telcos are the ones who took that risk and for most part, they're being rewarded deeply for it.
It's useful to, I guess, think about the or to acknowledge the fact that better is relative. So better relative to what in the context of what is cheaper, more accessible, makes sense culturally, et cetera. So I very much appreciate the distinction. So even though, at least from my relatively uneducated perspective, it seems as if payments providers are moving to serve multiple segments, for the purposes of this conversation, we're going to focus on consumer payments. And so let's start with the basics. How do consumer payments even work, and what does the payment infrastructure look like?
So for consumer payments, I think you have like two distinct models. One is where the product or service provider owns and operates all of the underlying infrastructure. So let's look at M-Pesa in Kenya as an example that is at least widely known and understood. So M-Pesa owns the entire stack, right? And when I say the entire stack, it actually starts from the physical towers that offer the network service. A layer above that, you've got the actual telco network, which coordinates and operates the network. And then on top of that, you've got the core mobile money platform, the back end that has got the ledger and records of Tayo sending Wiza like $50,000 one day, I hope.
we both hope.
And then you've also got like, you know, the consumer experience, right? The app, you've got the USSD code, the SIM toolkit push. Then you've also got the agent network, right? The contractual obligation with these third-party vendors who are human ATMs that help you cash in and cash out. When you own all of that stack, you can move very quickly because you don't have any third-party dependencies, and you have a real sense of ownership over your destiny. And I think that's why telco mobile money continues to remain relevant. On the flip side of that coin, it's very difficult to own the full stack across a very wide geography. So, you know, within one country, you pretty much see like dominant individual players who own the entire stack, and they offer their solution and service, and you know, they own all the different pieces. But when you're looking at like cross-border pieces, it becomes much more complex to start to own the whole stack. And then you start to see the second model where you only own specific parts of the infrastructure stack, and you sort of like rely on partners for everything else. And one of the clear examples of this is what I would describe as over-the-top mobile money. This is in contrast to telco mobile money, who own everything, but over the top, you ride on top of somebody else's rail in order to facilitate your service. And one of the biggest enablers of this model has been the internet and the underlying API economy. So now it's possible for a third-party app to be introduced into the market using the internet, make their service available to users via either a website or an app, and plug into the respective infrastructure stacks of all of the different mobile money players in a region, and basically allow systems that don't talk to each other to be able to talk to each other cross-border. The technical term for this in the industry is interoperability, and a lot of value is being created for OTT players at the interoperability layer. The challenge with the second model is that you don't really get to control your costs because, you know, you're buying everything from everyone else, and you're put in a position where in some scenarios you're competing with full stack players like mobile operators who are partnering with other mobile operators in their region to enable, you know, interoperability. And then you're also competing with other OTT players, and your customer is extremely price sensitive. So what tends to happen is that you have a race to the bottom on price, and it becomes quite challenging for you to make money on a transaction fee model. You typically have to have some sort of value-added service in order for your solution to become viable. And some of the common value-added services we see are things like, you know, adding a card into that wallet or allowing you to invest in fractional stocks or get access to cryptocurrencies and other sort of like tradable commodities that improve the stickiness and retention of your app and enable you to monetize users better. And I think this is the state of what consumer payments mostly look like for the continent today in a mobile money fashion. For the banking world, it's actually a little bit more complex. And the analogies I have are mostly centered around South Africa. Consumer payments in South Africa are predominantly bank-led, again, because the banking system just works for everything. I don't need like a third-party app. But you do see certain solutions like pass-through wallets. There's a solution called SnapScan and Zapper that lets you pay with your bank-attached card in a similar fashion to the way you would with PayPal in the US by scanning a QR code at a physical point of sale or sending money to somebody using their SnapScan, you know, username rather than their bank account. And in my view, these solutions haven't really seen significant scale, right? So it's a cool thing that maybe a bunch of fintech bros might do when they're speaking to each other. But like for the vast majority of the country, people just pay each other through regular bank transfers, which are called EFTs here. In Nigeria, I actually think that the fintech players on the consumer side have gone well beyond offering the vanilla payment stack in order to improve that stickiness. And my paragon example here would be OPay, right? So OPay in Nigeria just announced crossing the 50 million user mark. And that app is brilliant, I must say. It's just like, it's out of this world for me. While you have this very sophisticated banking infrastructure in Nigeria, you still have some gaps in terms of the reliability. So sometimes you do a bank transfer and it doesn't settle in time or it gets rejected or it gets refunded. In the OPay app, you can open that and then they'll show you like a list of the banks and their performance on the central bank network. So you can see like transactions to XYZ bank have been 98% successful in the last, 24 hours, right? And it'll rank the banks according to performance. And then they put a guarantee in the app that says, like, if you're transferring money from your OPay account to somebody's OPay account, I think it's something like if it doesn't get happened in 10 seconds, they will refund you the full amount, but honor the transaction, right? It's like this like insane level of like value that you can't really ignore it, right? In addition to this, you also have your OWealth wallet, which is an interest earning wallet. I think you can earn up to like 20 or 25% per annum in Naira. And you can put money in your OWealth wallet and earn funds daily, but you can also transact with it on a daily basis like you would with a checking account in the US. So you don't have any lockup period, right? And like, again, this is very hard to ignore, right? So when I open my OPay, all the Naira I have, I put in my OPay because I don't have anywhere else to put it. But at least if I put it in my OPay, I'm going to be earning something. And they send you a notification every day showing you how much you've earned that day. And like that is like brilliant strategy. And they don't own any of the underlying infrastructure. They're all purely over the top, over the internet. And they're becoming very quickly one of the most relevant consumer financial services as a result. So it's a very long and convoluted answer. But I think they've taken advantage of the various APIs that exist in Nigeria's fintech economy and have been able to build a very valuable product as a result. And everyone else who's in the space has got access to the same Legos, if I may, to build this thing. But it's all about how you put the pieces together in order to create, a truly outstanding experience that customers will stick around for.
So just to recap that point, because I think it's a really important one, both in the scenarios where the player owns, let's just say, the whole stack versus one where it's OTT or distributed, how would you characterize the optimal positioning of those Lego blocks? So in the second scenario, it sounds like it's something around insane consumer value, which leads to stickiness, but much rather hear it from you. So in those two scenarios, what is the best way to place the Lego blocks?
I think it really depends on what your objectives are and what sort of resources you have access to, right? So if you have access to more resources, I think you can generally take more risk and experiment more aggressively than somebody who doesn't have resources. If you're pretty small and you're trying to like find where you can plug into the ecosystem, you're going to put the Legos where you can put them, right? Based on your reach. And I think it's very challenging to give like a specific formula answer to that. I think I would be doing your listeners a disservice if I was to try to answer it in that way. I think everyone has to decide what Legos they're going to use and where they're going to put them based on how big their Toy Story is.
I like the analogy. Legos in a toy store works very well for me. But let's push this a little bit. I mean, we've talked to some degree about the technical side of things. So let's continue and talk a little bit more about the business side of things, for lack of a better way of putting it. So in the last episode, I had a chat with Samora Kariuki, who's the founder of the newsletter Frontier FinTech. And in one of his articles called Stripe, Paystack, Flutterwave, and Why Payments is Such a Big Industry, he made the argument that back-end infrastructure builders have a competitive advantage over front-end API-driven players, which you've kind of disproven a little bit with your with your OPay example. So to be honest, I'm not entirely sure how clear the boundaries are or will be indefinitely, but it might be useful to compare the two from a business perspective, maybe starting with front-end. So from your perspective, again, what is the core value proposition, which you've kind of described, and business model for a front-end API-driven company?
I know Samora quite well. I think he's probably one of the most brilliant minds that we have thinking about financial services on the continent. And I read his writings religiously. I actually don't disagree with him, right? OPay is an exception rather than the norm. And OPay also had a really big toy store. So,
sure did.
Yeah, they're predominantly backed by the Opera Group, which is a Norwegian browser conglomerate. I think many people are familiar with the Opera browser. And then they also had quite a bit of Chinese investment and sort of like private equity injection that allowed them to really invest in putting the Legos together in such a way that you build this great toy that the consumers can't resist. But the really big challenge around consumers is that there's a very high cost to acquire them, typically, depending on the product or service that you're offering. The consumers themselves are very fickle, so they churn quite easily. The switching cost for them is very low, especially in a market like Nigeria, where all you need is your phone number and your BVN to sign up to a new financial service. And then there's also like lots of competition that is based on price. So transaction fees are less appealing as a revenue model. Whereas when you're an infrastructure player, the analogy that I like to use is the gold and shovels, sort of like an analogy. So if there's a gold rush somewhere and you're the one selling all the shovels, you're going to make money regardless of whether or not people find gold. And that's what we see happening here.
Right.
And for infrastructure companies, they play a very fundamental role because of the aggregation problem that exists, not only in financial services, but also in telecoms. I don't have a very nice academic definition for it, but I can illustrate with an example. So suppose you are a business in Nigeria or in Kenya, and you need to collect from all of the different payment methods, right? So you need to be able to collect from banks. You also need to be able to collect from M-Pesa. You need to be able to collect from Airtel Money. And you also need to be able to collect from Telkom T-Cash. If you go to M-Pesa, M-Pesa can only give you the integration for M-Pesa. They cannot give you the integration for Airtel because they're direct competitors. So you have a need, because of this fragmentation, for there to be a neutral third party who can aggregate all of these payment methods and give you a single point of integration so that you can get access to everything. And this aggregation problem exists not only at a country level, but also continentally. So now if you're trying to do Pan-Africa, you have to think about multiple payment methods in multiple countries. And then you need an aggregator who can do that. And as a result, the payments industry is extremely layered, right? For all of the big aggregators in a given country, you find that they work with other bigger aggregators who sub-aggregate them for that country. And then you have the same model for entire continents. And then you have the same model for like entire regions, right? So at eBanks, where I work today, we're a global payment aggregator covering 29 countries, right? And when I come to Africa, not only in Africa, so we're in Latin America, we're in Africa, we're in India as well. So when you look at that company from a South African perspective, that's a huge company, right? If you get it from an African perspective, it's a big, relevant player. When you look at it from a global perspective, we're actually one of the smaller ones. There are bigger players who would see us and say like, hey, we should start aggregate these guys so that we can add to our coverage. And it's a very, very interesting model that exists not only for payments, but also for telecoms infrastructure, basically any sort of digital service, which is highly commoditized and has got multiple players in the space, can typically be, you know, aggregated. And you see this playing out in various ways. So as a result of this, the infrastructure players actually end up creating a lot of value because the consumer players have to buy the underlying infrastructure for them, regardless of whether or not they're going to monetize their user, and they never know upfront. On the flip side, if there's a very high degree of revenue to be captured at either the first mile or the last mile of the transaction, those are typically the places where the consumer interface facilitates that, then there's a very significant opportunity for the consumer business to make a lot of money from that. And I'll give an example of remittance companies, right? So if you're a consumer remittance company and you control the exchange rate and you're able to find a segment of customers who don't mind paying your exchange rate, if you're using local payments infrastructure to do your collections and disbursements in each country, so in Nigeria, maybe you might be integrated to like a Flutterwave or a Paystack for Naira, and in the US, maybe you're integrated to a Stripe or a PayPal for dollars, and you have the opportunity to do like the Forex conversions yourself. If you can get customers who are willing to pay, you know, the central bank rates for Nigeria for remittances, meanwhile, you're able to acquire Naira at the parallel market rates, that's a massive delta that you can capture and retain. And you see some of the largest consumer fintech companies are able to take advantage of this in order to generate these like massive, massive revenues as a result. A good example of that is Wise. The Wise is now starting to own more of their own infrastructure stack. I think Cash App is a decent example as well in the US, especially with their fractional stock and cryptocurrency service. There's quite a bit of cost that they can control there. So it really depends on, I think for consumer, you only start to make money when you're at significant enough scale and have a sticky product. And for infrastructure, you can easily make money from day one if you're allowing access to the right pieces of the stack. And in this way, you'll see that a lot of the valuable fintech businesses in Africa are actually infrastructure businesses. You have much fewer consumer fintech businesses that are perceived to be valuable, with the exception of the full stack players, because they are simultaneously consumer and infrastructure at the same time.
So what are the implications for that logic then? Because if I were to kind of restate it in an oversimplified manner, there seems to be a lot of collaboration / integration in the ecosystem due to the multi-layered nature of aggregation. So what are the implications of that reality for this idea of disruption and leapfrogging traditional players that are underserving populations? And as a second half of that, the logic of venture capital, which seems to be predicated on picking a monopolistic winner.
I often struggle to reconcile those two worldviews, right? I think the idea of like leapfrogging and disruption is rather Silicon Valley-esque in its origin. And when you look at Africa, it's like, okay, you're trying to disrupt payments infrastructure in Africa. My boss, there's no payments infrastructure to disrupt. what are you disrupting? Nothing to disrupt. I get a little bit. I try not to get frustrated because I realize just the extent to which that Silicon Valley narrative has permeated and is somewhat disconnected from the idea on the ground. Mm-hmm. A very good friend of mine, Dario Kochu, who's the CEO of Onafrique, formerly known as MFS Africa, one of the largest payments infrastructure businesses on the continent. He always tells people, and they ask him like, oh, but how do you think about this? What about disruption? He always says the competition is with cash, which I couldn't agree more with. Because according to data from Network International, which is one of the largest point of sale hardware distributors on the continent. They own a bunch of the other payments companies like DPO and PayFast. And I think they just got acquired by a UK private equity firm for close to $1 billion. Their stats from 2020 indicate that over 90% of retail transactions in Africa are still in cash. Right. So all of this fintech that we have been doing, all of us, the telcos, the banks, you know, the OTT players, the, everyone, all of us have not yet reached 10% of like the actual, solving the actual problem, right? And there's a lot of work to be done. I think people generally severely underestimate the significance of this issue of the lack of infrastructure that's being built for the first time. And when you're in this stage, if you look at some of the really big financial systems in the world, let's go to the extreme end and look at SWIFT, which is used by banks for international transfers. Can you imagine what would have happened if all the banks decided to say, like, we're not going to integrate to SWIFT, we'll just build our own thing? Like, you know, it's tempting to want to be a big fish in a little pond. But I think that right now we're actually in an ocean. So exactly. We need to work together as fish.
It makes complete sense. And I actually think, I might be misremembering, but I actually think they did try before SWIFT to build individually. Like there was one bank, Samora actually wrote about this. So there was one bank that tried to build and the rest were like, no, we don't agree. So then they decided to come together and create a standard that everyone would sign up to. So if infrastructure is, again, to oversimplify, the winning game in the long term, what fundamentally does it take to build a big, valuable business? I don't know that it makes sense to talk about mass adoption, but to your point about playing well together, it doesn't make sense if there are, well, okay, it makes sense to a certain extent if there are islands of infrastructure, but only to a certain extent. So what does it take to build a big, semi-ubiquitous, successful infrastructure business?
It's very interesting to me that you used the word ubiquitous, because I was about to use that word. And I'm going to shout out another one of my friends. You know, one thing about me, like if you're smart, I'll put you on. So
do it.
one of my friends is Osariman Osamui. He writes a publication called The Subtext that has got deep dives into specific moments and specific industries in the African tech industry. I highly recommend it, the subtext.io. So we're having a conversation one day and he says to me that, like, you know, the success of M-Pesa is because it is ubiquitous to the point of invisibility. And
mic drop.
Yeah. I was like, oh wow. You're actually right. It's not something that you think about, right? So if you're in Nairobi, Mombasa, or any major urban center, even most rural areas in Kenya, you don't have to think about how you're going to pay. You just know that your counterparty is going to accept M-Pesa, right? And you know, I lived in Kenya for 4 years. I never had a scenario where I couldn't pay somebody with M-Pesa. There were instances where people didn't have their own accounts, but they'll be like, yeah, send it to my sister. And they know their number, like, you know, off memory. And I think that that should be the goal for payments products and payment standards. How do you get to the point of being as ubiquitous as cash, for instance? There's nowhere in the world where if you have a $100 bill, you cannot pay for something, right? Like,
exactly.
It's respected. People know. Like, this is money, right? And it's easy to forget in all the glitz and glamour of product features and functionality that at the end of the day, the core purpose of payments businesses is to enhance the reach of money, right? You're trying to replace cash as people's idea of money. That's a very difficult thing to do because people's idea of money is closely tied to their understanding of value. And how do you become, in their eyes, instead of cash, the thing that represents value? That is a really, really challenging thing. In terms of like how you actually do that, I think there are like many different factors. You obviously have to have a product that is able to address the needs of the population at scale. It has to be reliable. It has to be trusted. And then you also need to be able to distribute that product in an environment without any negative regulatory precautions. And the landscape differs across different countries. That makes it particularly challenging. You need to have localized expertise in each of the countries in order to check that box. But it is a fundamental thing that you absolutely have to do in order to reach meaningful scale. And I think those are the core determinants around success.
So you use the word hard. And I was going to, I think I might have mentioned this to you in kind of our preliminary email exchanges. I was going to name this episode The Hard Thing About Payments. And the reason I was thinking about this is because, again, from my uneducated perspective, when thinking about the most obvious use case of a sector, although fintech is horizontal, is fintech, because it most, to some extent, most closely fits the idea that you're supposed to be able to build stuff that is mostly tech-driven, not physical, where the marginal cost of producing another or distributing another widget is close to zero, et cetera, et cetera. And of all of the sectors, fintech is most closely aligned to that. So it seems to make the most sense. And then in my mind, I was thinking it's one of the easier ways to fit into this model. But is it easy, though? it's building a payments bit, because we're talking quite casually about things that seem relatively complicated. So is it easy to build a semi-ubiquitous infrastructure business on the continent? If so, why not?
In my view, it's not. And I used to have the view before I got into fintech, I was mostly in telecoms. And telecoms is really obeys that principle quite closely. So in telecoms, we were selling access to telco API infrastructure on a per unit basis. So we could buy like an SMS from the telco from the equivalent of one US cent and then sell it to you for like 10 US cents. And we can onboard, thousands of customers every day because you just sign up and get an API key and, you know, approve your sender ID and you're good to go. That was a sweet business. That was a very sweet business. And then I made the mistake of thinking that, the next thing is payments. We can also distribute payments in this way and we can capture more, you know, transaction fees and this is more useful and we can target consumers. So I jumped in thinking that it's going to be the same journey. When I did, I quickly realized that unlike other parts of the world that in which it actually is truly a very small marginal cost for each new, you know, customer you onboard, because maybe they just have to download your app or do something. In Africa, it's not the same, right? So if you're setting up a mobile money service or a financial service, a lot of your distribution is offline. You think that somebody's just going to download your app and follow the instructions, but no, they want to call. They want to call a call center. They want to call a call center, talk to somebody. They want to go to an agent and have the agent, like, you know, press the phone for them. You know, I was looking at recent GSMA data that for the State of the Mobile Money Industry report for 2023 that came out a few months ago. And they say that 31% of sub-Saharan African mobile money users cannot use the service without assistance from another person, right? So it's things like these that really end up defining the reach and access that you're able to have. And they can be very costly to acquire up front. It's very interesting. I actually published earlier this week an article entitled The Hard Thing About Subscription Payments in Africa.
Yes.
And that was like very, very specific to the nature of recurring payments. I don't know if you had a chance to check that out, but it also speaks to, yeah, the some of the intricacies that exist and the need for offline distribution. So the idea that you distribute your app only online, I think so far has been a myth in Africa. One of the most successful digital remittance businesses on the continent is headquartered here in South Africa, and they're called Mukuru. And it's a very beautiful experience on the app. They've got a WhatsApp bot. Like, in terms of product, I think they would be best in class for consumer remittances. But at the same time, if you go to, you know, major cities in Zambia, in Malawi, in Zimbabwe, like where their remittance destinations are, there's like bunches of Mukuru agents where you can just walk up and be like, hey, how do I use this thing? Right? And like, despite all of this product innovation that they've done, it's only a very small segment of, you know, people like you and I who can speak to each other over the internet using Riverside with our MacBooks and our AirPods. You know, it's very funny. The other time I saw a tweet from someone who was saying that, like, you know, you see fintech founders talk about, oh, we want to bank the unbanked, and then their first product is only available on iPhone. So there's definitely a disconnect there. And because of that, I would say, I think it's harder than people think. I don't think anyone thinks it's easy, but it's harder than people think.
Yeah, that offline distribution point is incredibly interesting from a couple of different perspectives. So Osa Rumen and I, along with Tony Chen, worked on a report a couple of years ago, Chasing Outliers, which talks about the context of venture capital investing. And one of the key insights from that report was exactly what you said, that this idea of, hey, you're going to drop this app into a population and expect it to be a completely digital experience isn't reflective of reality, that it's more of a tech touch type of situation. And there more often than not is going to be a human touch point at some point along the line. So in thinking about that as one of probably many other distinguishing characteristics of how people on the continent use tech, to what extent do you think that the payment problems that you'd find on the continent, or if you want to be more specific, the ones found in Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Malawi, et cetera, resonate in other emerging markets? And I'm sure you have a perspective on this given your work at eBanks.
Yeah, so I'm very new to LATAM, but I think I've learned a lot in the 9 months that I've been working at eBanks. Very grateful for that opportunity. And I realized that there's actually like a lot of similarities. I think many more similarities than differences. You have the fragmentation issue at many levels. So the fragmentation of payment methods, of cultures, of languages is very significant. And then you also have this behavior around uncertainty avoidance, so distrust of financial services. One of the most popular payment methods in Brazil is a boleto, which is essentially a voucher-based payment system where you would go with cash, exchange it for a boleto voucher, and then enter the boleto voucher number into an online service and then redeem that cash. It's really, really popular, right? Hmm. You've also got like OxoPay in Mexico, where you have a large chain of retail stores that can accept cash for you for digital goods and services or for e-commerce payments in general. And you see this everywhere, like even in South Africa, the more sophisticated country in the Sub-Saharan African region. If you go into a major supermarket store like a Pick and Pay or a ShopRite, you'll have like a money market. And the money market is a kiosk with a physical person there, right? And then they can guide you through a whole suite of financial services. I was actually speaking on a panel last week in Cape Town at the Africa Tech Festival, where we're talking about this distribution issue. And I made the point that Pick and Pay, which is a supermarket chain, is actually like one of the largest financial services in South Africa. And people were like stunned at that point. It's like, no, go to a money market, like see what you can do at a money market. You can send money, you can buy a SIM card, you can deposit cash, you can withdraw. There's like the super app of financial services is a kiosk in South Africa. Right. So you see this commonality in many Latin American countries as well. I've also had quite some decent exposure to India. And I think I draw a lot of parallels between Nigeria and India specifically, especially in the realm of like real-time payments. So in Nigeria, you've got NIBS, in India, you've got UPI. A lot of people don't know this, but Nigeria's NIBS is actually the sixth largest real-time payment network in the world by volume.
No kidding.
As of last year. Yeah, so it's a pretty big deal. And UPI in India works very similarly. You've got this unified interface for making payments across different types of payment methods. And they're all instant, and it all works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you can see very clearly the same adoption curve that took place in Nigeria with NIBS, mapping very closely with UPI in India. And another commonality is that with India, you've got a centralized digital identity system. I think it is called Aadhaar. I just want to be very, very sure before I disrespect. Yes, the UIDAI is the authority, Aadhaar. So yes. Your Aadhaar is your, you know, biometrically guaranteed digital identity in India that you can use to sign up for various kinds of financial services. And in Nigeria, you've got BVN. I think BVN is like the best thing to happen to Nigeria's fintech ecosystem in the last 10 years because it really abstracted the complexity of KYC and onboarding compliance to a centralized authority who is neutral in the sense of the market actors and allows everyone to, you know, level the playing field. I don't think that a business like OPay would have gotten to where it is today if they had to figure out, you know, how to do KYC and onboarding for 50 million people and remain compliant. Right.
Right.
So I think these pieces of infrastructure play a very fundamental role in enabling an ecosystem to develop and enabling people to move forward and try things. And similarly with Pix in Brazil, which is extremely recent, I think it was only launched in 2020, it's gone from being non-existent to, again, being one of the predominant real-time payment networks in the world. I'm serving millions of people who otherwise, you know, might not have been included in the financial system. So same, I think.
same, indeed. So it's interesting. So your point about OPay having to essentially build everything, again, is something that we heard a lot about, the idea of verticalizing the value chain. So startup X goes in the market expecting to do a discrete activity, maybe it's supplying dukas, and then they end up supplying dukas and financing them and helping farmers to produce better organic crops, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what you're pointing out, at least in the payments use case, for lack of a better way of putting it, is that there are very real limits to that logic. You can only build so much. You can only be responsible for so much. You can only figure out so much in any given point in time. The other bit that's interesting is the idea of NIBs tracking, I'm going to mispronounce it, Aadhaar, which kind of leads into thinking about trends in the future. I personally hate trend questions. I think they're just a trap for, it's essentially a trap to force people to make predictions that are unlikely to come true. However, I will couch this in terms of thinking about how payments might evolve in the next few years. What has been satisfactorily built and what still remains to be built. So what problems are still pressing that need to be solved for payments to be functional and let's call it complete?
I also dislike trend questions because I feel like if I had the answers, I would just become the world's best VC.
Thank
now.
You. Right? We could both retire and then I could send you 50,000 and you can send me 60,000 back.
Yeah, you know, just like, you know, like, hey, dash you something small for the weekend. So obviously I preface this with a massive tub of salt. I think there's definitely a few things that could take place. Number one, I think is going to be, at least for the fintech layer, right? So these are the venture funded businesses that mostly popped up since 2018. Around that time, I think there's going to be a lot of like consolidation there because the market sentiment has changed. Interest rates are high. And you know, there's a lot safer places to put your dollars than with like a 24-year-old in Abuja who says they're going to change the world. And that's going to lead to quite a bit of consolidation, I hope, at reasonable prices. And I think that even though it might not seem like a very fantastic outcome, especially for like first-time founders, I think it really sets them on the right path. I think people really underestimate what $1 million is. People have been throwing around $1 million all over Twitter. And like, it's a small amount. There's nowhere in the world where $1 million is not, where you're not rich.
Exactly.
As a dollar millionaire, right? There's nowhere in the world. And even if you have that outcome and like, you know, you get to pocket like, you know, 300, 400, 500K, for many people in Africa, you're already like the first person to have that level of wealth in your entire generation, 8 generations back. Right. So people underestimate the significance of that. And I think as the market reality starts to settle, people are going to be forced to look into alternatives to raising capital because the days of $3 billion pre-seeds, I think those days are gone. for now. And in addition to that, I think there's going to be a lot of intentional interoperability. I hope, in my view, the best case would be like at a policy level where you have state actors incentivizing private players to interoperate their financial systems. We've seen this to various degrees in multiple countries, and I think it's mostly like really worked. Imagine if you had NIBs, but then like it was optional for, you know, the banks to use it. It wouldn't have taken off as quickly. And with that interoperability, the outcomes are going to be like unified payment experiences. I have far too many cards than I would like to be able to move around with one card, but I have my Malawi card for buying my Malawi stuff. I have my South Africa card for buying my South Africa stuff, and I can't use my Malawi card on the South African website. I can't use my Nigerian card on any other website. And it's such a pain. And the infrastructure hasn't evolved to reflect the mobility of Africans within the continent today. It's 4 p.m. right now, right? Like if I wanted to be in Nairobi tonight, all I need to do is catch KQ 762, which is departing Johannesburg or Tambo at 5:30 today. I'll be in Nairobi at 10 p.m. If I miss that one, I can catch 763 or 764, which departs around 2 a.m. And then I'll be in Nairobi 6 a.m. tomorrow. I think the Lagos flight just left. It leaves at 4:15 usually. That's SA 62. Like people are moving within the continent, right? People are moving, and the financial services infrastructure hasn't evolved to reflect that degree of mobility. And I think that this is a global problem. Yesterday, I was trying to update my iPhone apps, and there's certain apps that I can only use on the South African Play Store, App Store. And there's also certain apps that I can only get on the US App Store. So my primary account is a US account, and then my South African is secondary. But all the South African services are on the South African App Store, with a few exceptions, who are available globally. So now I'm doing the update thing, password prompt pops up asking me to enter the Apple ID password for my South African account. And I have to enter that. When I enter that, it does the update, and then it signs me out of my US account. So the next time I download an app, I have to enter the US password.
Oh, no.
And like each time a South African app gets updated, I have to go through this very painful cycle. And like, I don't know, like, does Apple not think about the use case where like, oh, this person needs to use apps from different regions? Probably there's a lot of very smart people who have thought about the reasoning behind that constraint. But I think it speaks to a greater trend in general, where the world is so much smaller now because of the degree of travel options and because of the internet. I think after the advent of the internet, there are no secrets anymore. And I think the idea of the significance of nation states as a construct is starting to evolve as a whole. So a lot of things have been designed around the idea that like, oh, this is going to work in a country. But like, what is the significance of a country now when I'm here in Johannesburg speaking to you in the United States? And if I wanted to be, I could be having like dinner in Nairobi. So the world is becoming our oyster, which I think is fantastic in many ways. But the payments infrastructure has to evolve to enable us to, the way we send emails without ever thinking about like, oh, what is the Swift code for tires email?
Can you imagine?
I think that would be like the holy grail. And I think we'll get much closer to that within my lifetime. But I don't see it being like fully solved while I can see it.
So two things. One, I love the fact that you can code actual flights, because it suggests that you've taken these flights many times to the point where the numbers are ingrained in your brain. And number two, I don't think I've heard a more elegant description of why interoperability is paramount. The payments infrastructure has to move with Africans who are on the move.
Yeah.
Full stop, mic drop, period. Brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant way to put it. So as we wrap up here, so the premise of this series is trying to understand what the primary driving assumptions are behind VC in Africa as a whole, but then also disaggregated by specific opportunities. And so I am depending on the brilliant minds of people like yourself to surface these assumptions. So given your 17 years of robust experience with fintech in Africa, what would you describe as a counterintuitive first principle for understanding how to build a functional payment system on the continent?
Right. So I gave this quite a bit of thought because there are so many different things that I could say, but I ended up resolving to this one. And it kind of like hit me in the face when I realized it. So with fintech, right, one of your biggest cost centers comes from moving money around to different pools of liquidity to, you know, give the user a very seamless experience. So I'll use a practical example for this, right? So if you use a product like Flutterwave Send, which is a fantastic product, God bless GB, may he live long. You can use your like US credit card to send somebody who's in, you know, Nigeria Naira, and then they'll receive that Naira like, you know, within a minute or so. It's not that they have moved the Naira from the America and they've converted it. No. It's that they have some Naira sitting somewhere just waiting for people who want to, you know, send money from wherever, and then they keep the funds like, you know, in the US, and they might convert them at a later stage if it needs to happen. But the general point here is that you only make money if you don't move money around, which is very counterintuitive because you'd think that, hey, I need to find the most efficient way of moving the money around. But all of that is a cost center. So if you can deliver the illusion of money movement without actually moving any money around, that gives you opportunities to use your liquidity pools to generate revenue in interesting ways. So going back to that remittance example, imagine that Flutterwave Send has got a perfect treasury who have timed all of their calculations right, and they don't actually need to move money around. What that means is that they have, you know, all of a sudden a bunch of dollars that are sitting in the US that, you know, they don't need to do anything with right now. And, you know, depending on their relevant permissions, they can then, you know, decide to put that money or a portion of that money in bonds or in ETFs or in mutual funds and earn interest on those funds at a higher return than they would if they had transferred the money and charged Visa a transaction fee for the same. So I think this isn't always obvious for people who are getting into the space. And that's the one principle that I would share here of many.
Absolutely fantastic. I don't remember what I was listening to yesterday, but essentially the individual was explaining that there are basically two basic buckets of streams of revenue for financial services. One is something related to transactions and the other is something related to interest. So getting money to earn money. It never would have occurred to me that the possibility to do number two would be contingent upon not moving money around to earn number one. So I think that very, very much qualifies as counterintuitive. So Wiza, I don't know how to thank you. I've learned so much in an hour. It's been an absolute, well, it's been a blast, but it's also been supremely educational. I'm sure everyone who is listening will learn just as much as I did. Thank you so much for making the time. Thanks to all of you who are listening, and I hope you'll join us again. You can find The Trajectory Africa everywhere you listen to podcasts. Until next time.